Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday. This is the monthly podcast of the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison, and I'm your host. We'll be talking over the course of the next 30 minutes or so about recent developments in public safety labor relations issues. What's going on in the workplace that impacts firefighters, law enforcement officers, corrections officers, and all public safety employees? The first thing I want to talk about is actually a series of three decisions. We have our first answers in the country to the question of whether body-worn camera systems are mandatory for bargaining. Let me set the stage for these just a little bit. Employers, where you have collective bargaining rights, employers are typically obligated to bargain over some phrasing of wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. If there's an obligation to bargain over something, if something is a so-called mandatory subject of bargaining, the employer is not free to implement a change in that area without first negotiating with the union, unless somehow or another the union has waived the right to bargain over the change. So whenever you see an employer making substantial changes in policy, the first question you have to ask is this topic mandatory for bargaining? Does it have any sort of impact, negotiable impact, on wages, hours, or working conditions? Because if it does, then the employer is going to have to negotiate over that before it implements the change. What does negotiate mean in that context? What negotiate means is that it has to go through whatever the impasse resolution process is set forth in that particular state or with that employer. For most of the country, that means binding arbitration, which is the last step after negotiations and administration. For some portion of the country, a smaller number of states, predominantly headed by California and Florida, it means a period of negotiations that culminates with the employer being able to unilaterally implement its last best offer. But for most places in the country, again, it's binding arbitration is the last step in the bargaining process. That's what you'd expect to see in the Northeast, in the upper Midwest, certainly in the Pacific Northwest. So the question that we've been waiting to get answered with respect to body cameras is there something about a body camera system that is negotiable? And these first cases that we have in suggest there's a lot about body camera systems that are thought to be negotiable. But let me tell you first what was not at issue in any of these cases. What was not at issue was the core question of whether an officer should have the right to review a body camera video before giving a statement about a critical incident or writing a report about a critical incident. The policies in both of these cases that I'm going to be talking about, the policies allowed a pre-statement review. In fact, you probably know that's the recommendation of the Police Executive Research Forum. There's an interesting study that was done earlier this year by what's known as the Brennan Institute, which is a nonprofit think tank. The Brennan Institute did a survey and found that almost all major cities that had body camera programs allowed pre-statement review. As I said, that wasn't the issue in these cases because these agencies had decided officers should be able to review their videos before giving a statement. So what was that issue? Well, let's take the first case, which really is two separate decisions. It comes out of Montgomery County, Maryland. And Montgomery County does not bargain under a statewide collective bargaining law. Instead, it bargains under a local ordinance. So instead of having a state labor board with the ability to decide whether or not there are unfair labor practices or whatever, Montgomery County has a permanent umpire who decides what would normally be unfair labor practice sorts of issues. This permanent umpire is a guy named Ira Jaffe, well-respected arbitrator. That's his day job, is being an arbitrator. One of the most respected arbitrators in the country, who has a huge background, not just in public sector labor issues, but also private sector labor issues. The first of the Montgomery County cases that ends up in permanent umpire Ira Jaffe's lap is an unfair labor practice complaint, or the equivalent of it, filed by Lodge 35 of the Fraternal Order of Police, saying that the county had unlawfully failed to bargain over various aspects of a body-worn camera system. Jaffe ends up issuing two separate opinions. They're separated by about half a year. Two separate opinions on the negotiability of body camera systems. The first one is, I think of it as more of a broad brush opinion. In general terms, what is negotiable about a camera system and what is not. And then later on, in 2016, he issues, I think, a much narrower decision about particular aspects of a body camera system and what is and is not negotiable about those. What I'm going to do for purposes of this podcast is conflate those two and just give you a list, putting together the two opinions. They're quite long. They're over 80 pages long taken together, and conflate the two and give you the highlights of them. First of all, what did umpire Jaffe find negotiable about a body-worn camera system? And the answer is an awful lot. He found negotiable the type of system that was used, the location on the officers' bodies where the camera would be placed. He thought both of those had some safety implications and other working conditions implications. He found negotiable the weight and the size of the cameras, and whether or not there was a required wiring harness. Again, that's a working conditions slash safety issue. From an employee privacy standpoint, he found negotiable whether the cameras would have GPS tracking systems. Also from a privacy standpoint, he found negotiable whether or not the cameras could be remotely activated by the employer. He found negotiable for quite different reasons. Whatever records retention policies the employer would have with respect to videos, how long are these videos going to be kept around? He also found negotiable the designation of the units where body-worn camera systems would be put into place. And then finally, he found negotiable what a lot of people call trolling. I know that's kind of a negative name. What it is whether or not the employer has supervisors randomly reviewing body camera videos for evidence of officer non-compliance with rules. So this is review of videos, not in response to a particular incident, but simply taking a look at officer videos to see how they're doing on the job and whether they're complying with the employer's rules. And umpire Jaffe found that to be negotiable because of the disciplinary implications of that sort of practice. So when you put it all together in terms of these seven things that I've just ticked off that he found negotiable, and I haven't included all of them, by the way. You can read the opinion and find his entire list, and we'll post the opinion on our webpage, so feel free to go download it. When you look at those, you find some common threads. The first thread is the umpire is saying, look, if you can reasonably come up with a safety implication to something about a body camera video, it's going to be negotiable. Secondly, if you can come up with some sort of privacy implication to a body camera video, that's going to be negotiable. And lastly, if there are disciplinary consequences to the use of body camera videos by the employer, that will be negotiable as well. Now, the umpire also found a number of things, I'm going to pick five of them, that I think are the most significant, that were not negotiable about the body camera systems. The first was The Montgomery County system called for volunteers to use body cameras. The FOP had proposed, look, if there aren't enough volunteers, we're going to draft people in the inverse order of seniority. Said Arbitrator Jaffe, that goes too far. That impinges on the employer's right to assign work. The second thing he found negotiable was another FOP proposal that would have called for a complete ban on the use of body-worn camera videos for disciplinary purposes or performance evaluations. The umpire clearly found that the complete ban went too far. There's a suggestion in his opinion that if what the FOP had proposed had been a bit more measured, for example, if the FOP had said, if you're going to be trolling, and I'm just going to use that word rather than the long phrase to describe it, if you're going to be trolling, you can't use those for disciplinary purposes. Jaffe's opinion suggests to me that that would be negotiable. But the complete ban, he found, went too far. Similarly, third thing he found non-negotiable was a complete ban on the release of body-worn camera videos to other law enforcement agencies. Jaffe is saying, quite correctly, I think, look, there are some circumstances under which a cooperating law enforcement agency may need access to the body camera video for legitimate law enforcement purposes. And by proposing a complete ban on the release of these videos to other law enforcement agencies, even if they had those legitimate investigatory purposes, that goes too far. The fourth thing he found non-negotiable was the FOP's proposal that body-worn camera systems never be used for training purposes. Now, officers have a big concern about using body-worn camera videos for training purposes. You know, these videos sometimes capture officers in the most stressful moments of their lives. And sometimes they'll capture officers making tactical mistakes. Officers really don't want to be seeing those videos used as a training device by their employer 2 years from now, 5 years from now, where all of that is held up to public examination by their peers. Jaffe was very, very sensitive to that, but said the FOP's proposal for a complete ban of the use of these videos for training purposes went too far. And Jaffe cited the fact that it's possible to have face blurring software or other software that would limit the ability to identify the involved officer, and therefore you might be able to use the videos for training purposes. Again, he's finding the FOP went just an inch or half a mile or whatever too far with its proposal. And the last one was the FOP had proposed giving the officer the unrestricted right to ban the release of body-worn camera videos, period. And Jaffe, as you probably can gather from the tenor of the rest of his opinion, thought that went too far. Thought that, you know, while it might be appropriate to give the officer some degree of control over whether the videos are publicly released, giving the officer the unrestricted right to say yes or no, that's too much. So, at any rate, interesting decision, very, very thorough decision. Because of Jaffe's background, I think it has kind of a private sector feel to it a little bit, looking at the various NLRB cases that bear not so much on camera systems, but on these core issues of discipline and privacy and everything like that. Very interesting case. So those are the first two decisions, two separate decisions by umpire Jaffe. The third one came out in the last couple of weeks. And we actually did a brief podcast on this with one of the lawyers who was involved in this litigation. This was a grievance that went to arbitration between Oklahoma City and Lodge 123 of the Fraternal Order of Police. The city in Oklahoma City was implementing a body-worn camera system, and the city and the FOP were able to work out almost everything with respect to that policy. There was just one area where they ended up at loggerheads, and that was the issue of trolling, whether or not the employer should have the right to have supervisors randomly review body-worn camera videos to determine whether or not officers were complying with the employer's rules. Once again, the policy did provide for a prior review of body-worn camera videos before giving a statement about a critical incident, so that wasn't an issue here. The only question before the arbitrator was that of trolling. The arbitrator is a fellow who has roots in that area of the country, but primarily practices up in the Seattle area. His name is Zane Lumley. And arbitrator Lumley ended up finding pretty easily, he says, that the implementation of this trolling requirement, this random review requirement, that is negotiable. Here's what he says, and when I say he finds it pretty easily, that'll come through in his words. He says, "I believe the logical first step in deciding this issue is to determine whether implementation of the body-worn camera program constituted a change in working conditions sufficient to create a bargaining obligation. I simply have no doubt that it did. In so deciding, I agree completely with the union that the use of body-worn cameras constitutes an enormous change in the working conditions of police officers." Why? He says that he points primarily to the disciplinary consequences of a body-worn camera system. Going back to his opinion for a moment, the mandated circumstances in which the camera must be activated here strikes me as a large body of an officer's work that the body-worn camera program opens up to a completely different type of scrutiny that cannot be said to have been envisioned as among the rights understood by the parties at the time when they signed their contract. So the arbitrator sends the city and the FOP back to the bargaining table. In Oklahoma, the bargaining process does end in binding arbitration, and commands the FOP and the city to begin the bargaining process. So, we now have our first body camera decisions on negotiability. Are these going to be an anomaly, or are these going to set the stage for what the rule will be in the area? I suspect they're going to be the rule. There's long-standing precedent from the National Labor Relations Board that pretty much anything to do with the workplace camera program is mandatory for bargaining, and state labor boards really do take an awful lot of their guidance from the National Labor Relations Board. They're not legally obligated to follow what the NLRB does, but still, this is the country's most preeminent labor relations agency, so they do look to the NLRB for guidance. And I think that's going to be the way these cases come out. I think the body camera systems, in the end, I think they're going to be found to be negotiable, as they were in the Montgomery County case and in the Oklahoma City case. Next up, I've got a real treat for you, an Eighth Amendment case. Eighth Amendment. What's the Eighth Amendment? The Eighth Amendment is the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishments. How does that possibly come up in a public safety work environment? Well, there's it's not used very often at all. There is another clause to the Eighth Amendment. The Eighth Amendment is only one sentence long. Most of the Bill of Rights, those are only one sentence long. And the Eighth Amendment's like that. Let me read the whole thing to you. It'll take me about, 8 seconds. "Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted." That's it. It's the Eighth Amendment. You hear that part about fines? No excessive fines imposed? Okay, here's the case. The case involves a police officer for the city of Peabody, Massachusetts, a guy named Edward Betancourt. Been around a long time. He hired on in 1980. Eventually, by 2003, became a lieutenant. In the early morning hours on Christmas Day in 2004, Betancourt was on duty as a watch commander, and he starts messing around with his computer. And he accesses what's known as the Massachusetts Human Resources Division's computer system. And in particular, the division's internet site containing individual applicant record information. Let me pause for a moment. In Massachusetts, an awful lot of cities, maybe all, I would say all, except I actually haven't researched the issue. I'll say an awful lot of cities run their promotional tests through the state's human resources division. Boston does, for example. I'm going to talk about another Boston case in just a few minutes. And so what Betancourt is doing here is he's getting online to check out the promotional database for the Massachusetts Human Resources Division. And what he does is to look at the civil service promotional scores of 21 other officers, including four who were his direct competitors for promotion to the position of captain. He actually engages in quite a sleight of hand. He creates a distinct user account for each officer, and he enters the social security numbers and birth dates for the officers. Well, of course, you get into a computer system like that, and somebody knows, someone always knows, right? And in 2006, Betancourt is indicted for unauthorized access to a computer system. A year and a half later, after the conclusion of a bench trial, he's found guilty on all counts, and there were a ton of counts. The same day that he is found guilty, he applies for voluntary retirement with the Peabody Retirement Board. As of that date, he'd been a Peabody police officer for over 27 years and had been a member of the retirement system for over 25 years. Well, there's a provision in Massachusetts retirement law, it exists in many states, that calls for the forfeiture of retirement benefits if an employee is convicted of a crime that is related to the job. After the local retirement board learns of Betancourt's decisions, it has to decide, does he forfeit his retirement allowance? And a majority of the board concluded that none of the convictions were, and this is the phrasing of the Massachusetts statutes, a violation of the laws applicable to his office or position, and therefore the board says that his retirement should be granted. But not so fast, because the board's decision isn't final. It turns out it's a recommendation to a retirement commission, which takes the other point of view and rules that Betancourt's convictions did relate to his office or position, and therefore he forfeits his entire retirement allowance. The case eventually winds its way to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, and we have our Eighth Amendment issue. Is the forfeiture of Betancourt's retirement a fine that is potentially controlled by the Eighth Amendment? And here's what the court says. The court says, first of all, does Betancourt have a protectable interest in his retirement benefit? And the court says, yeah, at the time he became a police officer, he became a contributing member to the retirement system. There were deductions from his salary. He acquired a protected property interest in his retirement allowance. It doesn't mean that he can't forfeit his retirement interest. It just is simply to say that this he did have a protected interest that could potentially be forfeited. But to be valid, that forfeiture has to comply with the Eighth Amendment's rule that bars excessive fines. Court then turns to the next issue. Okay, we now know we got a property interest. We have a forfeiture of that property interest. Is that a punishment that is somehow controlled by the Eighth Amendment? And the court says, yes. We find that the forfeiture involves, these are the words of the court, an extraction of payments and is punitive. It therefore is a fine within the meaning of the excessive fines clause of the Eighth Amendment. Now to the key issue, the $64,000 question, and that is the forfeiture of his retirement an excessive fine? Well, what are we talking about? The court says first. Well, the court says he forfeits not just his retirement, he also forfeits his post-retirement medical insurance. Betancourt and the Retirement Commission disagreed over how much that post-retirement medical insurance was worth, but they could agree on how much the retirement was worth, and the net present value of the retirement was $659,000. Betancourt thought that the total value of what he was forfeiting with post-retirement medical insurance was over $1 million. But the court says, well, you know what, let's just accept the $659,000. That's a pretty big amount of money. And the court says, okay, now what we've got to do is we have to measure on one hand the degree of Betancourt's criminal culpability. We have to look at the nature of his offenses. We have to look at whether or not he was engaged in a course of illegal behavior. We need to look at things like the maximum sentence and the harm that resulted from Betancourt's behavior. We need to look at all of those sorts of things, and then we need to balance them against that $659,000 plus. And the court says, on balance, that's an excessive fine. Why? First of all, the court says the trial judge, the guy who found Betancourt guilty, observed there was no evidence that Betancourt made any use at all of the private information. In fact, he was simply snooping. So we don't have, like, Mr. Career Criminal at work here. Second, the court says, Betancourt's offenses were unrelated to any other illegal activities. He had no criminal record. There's no evidence that he engaged in any other misconduct besides the one Christmas Day episode of getting into these computer files. Third, when we look at the maximum punishment for the crimes at issue, these are misdemeanors, and what the legislature has set as a maximum fine for a misdemeanor is no more than $1,000, which, here's the words of the court, suggests to us that the legislature did not view this crime as a grave, serious offense. Bottom line, here's the court's ruling. We conclude that the complete forfeiture of Betancourt's retirement benefits in excess of $659,000 accrued over a lengthy career as a full-time municipal police officer was not proportional to the gravity of the underlying offenses on which he convicted, and the forfeiture violates the excessive fines clause of the Eighth Amendment. And the court orders that Betancourt's retirement be restored. I have gone my whole career without seeing an Eighth Amendment case coming up in a labor relations context. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to see this decision. And I think the court reached the right result here. It's nice to see it struggling with an area where there really isn't an awful lot of case law, but I think this is the correct result. Now all I'm waiting for is a Third Amendment case. You're wondering, right? What's the Third Amendment? To save you having to look it up, the Third Amendment is we can't be forced to quarter soldiers in our houses. If I see that in a public safety discipline case, my professional life will be complete. While I'm talking about Massachusetts, let me stay there for that Boston case that I was going to tell you about. It's a, I think, a very significant racial discrimination case arising out of a promotional examination. Even though it's a little bit fact-specific, I think this has, I think, a lot of significance for anybody who is using promotional examinations, using written examinations as even part of a promotional examination. So what's going on in this Boston case? We're talking about two promotional examinations for the position of sergeant in the police department, one in 2005 and another in 2008. Once again, this is a test that's administered by the state of Massachusetts Human Resources Division, and it has the statutory charge of coming up with examinations that fairly test the knowledge, skills, and abilities required for a particular job. The testing process that the division, I'll call it HRD, the Human Resources Division. The testing process that HRD came up with was the product of a long-running effort to eliminate the use of race in public employment decisions, and also to eliminate the vestiges of political patronage, which went on in Boston for a lot longer than patronage systems went on in a lot of other cities. What are the examinations look like in 2005 and 2008? The first thing is there's no room for subjectivity in the examination process. There's no assessment center. There's no oral interview. They want a strictly objective testing system. Why? Because if you have subjective testing systems like an assessment center or like oral examinations or like job interviews with applicants, that's where you have the possibility of implicit or explicit bias creeping in, either on a racial basis or a political basis or favoritism basis, whatever it might be. So in Massachusetts, they're looking for objectivity. There were two components to the sergeant's exam. One was an 80-question written examination that was scored on a 100-point scale. And then there was a separate education and experience rating based on the education and experience of the applicants. That was also scored on a 100-point scale. The written exam counts for 80%, and the education and experience rating comprises the remaining 20%. Applicants, in order to be considered for promotion, need to get a score of 70. On top of their raw scores, they get a couple of bonuses if they're military veterans or they have long service records with the state. And then what the city of Boston does, once this exam is implemented by the HRD, the tests are given, and Boston gets the scores, is it promotes people on a rank order basis. Just goes from the top of the list down to the bottom of the list. So where do the questions come from? The questions date back to what's known as a validation study in 1991. Let me pause here for just a moment. That word validation, in the context of equal employment claims, race, gender discrimination claims, that word validation is a term of art. And basically what it means, and I'm really shortcutting a lot here, but what it means is that the employer, or whoever is constructing the test, has studied the job in question and has been able to come up with test questions that predict how applicants for the job will perform if they get the job. So you're looking at, for example, studying what the different job requirements are. What is it a police sergeant does on a day-to-day basis? And then coming up with test questions that attempt to draw upon that body of information. A sergeant, for example, might have to deal with an employee who's late for work, or a sergeant might have to approve a police officer's report. You'd have questions that would focus on that sort of thing. In other words, what you're looking for is, with the validation process, Aren't these test questions predictive of how someone's actually going to do on the job? Okay, back to Massachusetts. This 1991 validation study, HRD surveys officers in 34 jurisdictions nationwide, giving them a questionnaire that tries to determine what do you need from police office that police officers around the country deem critical in the performance of a sergeant's responsibilities. The state then conducts constructs a list based upon this survey, distributes the list to higher-ranking officers in Massachusetts who were asked to rank the traits according to how important they felt each was to a sergeant's performance, and then the test questions were constructed. And this is the sort of test that's been given for a long time in Massachusetts. Well, the results in 2005 and 2009 definitely showed a disparate impact on the basis of race with the giving of the test. In 2005, only 9 of the 224 black and Hispanic candidates who took the exam were promoted, whereas 57 of the other 401 were. In other words, Caucasian employees ended up with higher scores on the examination than black and Hispanic candidates. Same thing happened in 2008. Only 1 of the 213 black and Hispanic test takers were promoted, where 25 of the 291 other candidates were. And when you looked at the base numbers, the average scores for black and Hispanic candidates were lower than the scores for Caucasian candidates by 6.4 points in 2005 and 6.6 points in 2008. Well, if you have that sort of disproportionate impact on that breaks down on racial lines, you can be expecting a lawsuit. And that's exactly what happened. And a group of black and Hispanic test takers in the Boston Police Department challenged the test results on race discrimination claims. Case goes through the trial court and ends up with the Federal First Circuit Court of Appeals. That is, by the way, one of our better Federal Circuit Courts of Appeal. They tend to be thoughtful, particularly on these examination-type questions. They have a body of case law there that I think is the envy of most other places in the country. And they've thought through these things a lot of times, and I think they do a pretty good job of capturing where the law is. And what does the court do with this test? It upholds it, and it upholds the test results. First, the court says, we believe the test meets the standards for validity. The court cites the testimony of an expert witness who testified for the city, who said, look, while the test questions were very carefully constructed, they could have been improved upon. In particular, they haven't really been updated since 1991. And if the written test was the only part of the exam that was being given, I might worry about whether or not this is a valid test. However, the expert testifies that the education and experience component, that 20% component, and I'm quoting now from the court's opinion, effectively pushed the selection device as a whole over the finish line to show validity. It did this because the level and extent of work and educational experience and accomplishments listed by each applicant served as a useful, if imperfect, proxy for the kinds of qualities that were deemed to be important for a sergeant's daily responsibilities, but were insufficiently tested by the written exam. So in other words, where the written exam alone might not have cut the mustard, put together with the education and experience component, it did. The officers also argued that without regard to the test validity, the fact that Boston then used rank order selection, that led to a disparate impact on the basis of race. And the court's very, very careful in the way it addresses this issue. And it's so careful, I want to read you three sentences from the court's opinion. Court disagrees with that. And here's what the court says. The use of a ranking device requires a separate demonstration that there is a relationship between higher scores and better job performance. Boston's selection methodology reliably predicts a candidate's suitability for the job such that persons who perform better under the test are more likely to perform better on the job. Rank ordering furthers the city's interest in eliminating patronage and intentional racism under the guise of subjective selection criteria, and that's a good enough business need to argue against moving away from rank order selection. And so the court dismisses the race discrimination lawsuit, even though there were adverse impact, was an adverse impact on the basis of race. Interesting case. And those of you who are in jurisdictions where you don't have rank order selection, and where you do have subjective tests being given, assessment centers or oral interviews or interviews with the supervisor or the police chief, I think you might well want to take a look at this opinion, because there's some suggestions in this opinion that what you're doing, if you're faced with a reverse discrimination lawsuit, may be constitutionally suspect. I want to end with a couple of disciplinary cases, one from New Jersey and another one out of Massachusetts. This is Massachusetts month here. And I want to contrast these two decisions because they show, I think, very separate sort of approaches to the issue of discipline. In New Jersey, there's a very constrained disciplinary appeals process. Disciplinary appeals go through an internal system, and eventually the disciplinary appeals end up in court. And once you get into court, there's an extremely deferential standard that is shown towards an employer's decision-making process, and extremely deferential in that I probably read hundreds of these New Jersey disciplinary cases a year. And it's rare that I ever see a disciplinary decision of a New Jersey firefighter, police officer, corrections officer that is overturned. Massachusetts, on the other hand, has a much more liberal system of appeal. It also ends up in court in many cases. A lot of times it's binding arbitration. A lot of times it ends up in court. But even in court, the appeal system has much more of an independent review by the court system. And look at the results in these two cases, and it will really illustrate that. So let's go to the New Jersey case first. It's a corrections case. It involves a corrections officer by the name of Dana Register, who works for the Mountain View Correctional Facility for the New Jersey Department of Corrections. DOC there apparently has a special investigations division. They get an anonymous note. And the anonymous note says, SCO, I assume that's Senior Corrections Officer, it's not clear from the opinion, SCO Register is messing with an inmate, initials TW, in the full minimum unit. She's getting out of hand. She writes some letters and mails them from a P.O. box in Easton, Pennsylvania. SID begins an investigation. They put what's known as a mail cover on a TW, that's the inmate's incoming and outgoing mail. They check his visitors list. They don't find any. They don't find any phone calls that he's received. But they do show that from February through September of 2013, TW was getting letters from somebody named Janelle Lewis. This is not Dana Register. This is from Janelle Lewis. And these letters contain romantic language like, I'm unable to show you the depth of my love for obvious reasons. Or, as I see you, I see with you so much love in your eyes for me. SID wants to track down Janelle Lewis. They check out this Easton, Pennsylvania return address, and they get absolutely no results. They then take a look at the inmate's trust account, and they see that he receives money orders from Janelle Lewis at that same address, totaling $1,050. And he also shows a deposit from somebody named Jamila Williams for $450. That's from a Newark address. So SID, hot on the trail now. They do a search of the Newark return address, and they get negative results. However, Dana Register, remember her? Her previous address was directly across the street from the fictitious Newark address. The inmate responds to Janelle Lewis by mailing letters to a P.O. box in Easton, Pennsylvania. The SID discovers that, and then finally SID learns from the Postal Service that the box was registered to Dana Register, who had requested authorization for use of the box by a 12-year-old daughter, Janelle Lewis. So Janelle Lewis is Register's daughter, or would be, if Register actually had a daughter, but she didn't. So finally, SID brings Register in, interviews her. She says that she wrote the letters, but she insisted the communications were merely friendly, denied there was any physical or sexual conduct between the inmate and her. She said she intended to continue a relationship with the inmate once he completed his sentence. She initially denied sending him the money orders, but then later admitted that she had. DOC isn't amused, and they fire her. And Register appeals her discharge into court. And her primary argument is, this is the sort of case where I should be subject to progressive discipline. And the court is having none of it. The court says, look, we have a deferential standard of review with respect to disciplinary sanctions imposed by local employers. A reviewing court should alter a sanction imposed by an agency only where, and here I'm quoting, the punishment is so disproportionate to the offense in light of all the circumstances as to be shocking to one's sense of fairness. The court says this penalty, termination, isn't so shocking for us. And we don't have any obligation to even consider whether we're going to apply the principles of progressive discipline to Register's case. Termination upheld. All right, now up the turnpike to Massachusetts. This is a case involving a police officer. He works for the town of West Bridgewater, Massachusetts. His name is Daniel Desmond. And Desmond gets into romantic problems as well. Boy, I'll tell you, I've just become ultimately convinced that who's ever doing these podcasts 100 years from now is going to be talking about romantic problems that police officers, firefighters, and corrections officers have with people they meet on the job. Well, this is a case that involves a relationship between Desmond and a married woman who is referred to only in the court's opinion as Mrs. A. Mrs. A has marital problems with her husband, and she completes a restraining order, an application for a TRO against her husband. Desmond, who is involved with her, calls the Brockton Police, a nearby police agency, he tries to obtain information about who's on duty because Mrs. A lives in Brockton. Desmond eventually denies under oath in court later on that he assisted Mrs. A in completing the application for the TRO. However, Brockton has a videotape showing that he was present when she fills out the application. Desmond's actual employer, West Bridgewater, decides to terminate him, and to terminate him for dishonesty, lying under oath about whether or not he had actually helped Mrs. A complete this application. In fact, the department is able to cite four other instances of dishonesty. Desmond testified in court that he'd never seen the affidavit. In fact, he had seen the affidavit. He testified in court that he never came to the courthouse when Mrs. A had a court appearance. In fact, he escorted her to the clerk's office and left the building without entering the courtroom. He testified that he'd never been to her house, but he'd been there 6 days earlier. And in response to a question from one of the Brockton police officers, he denied being in the neighborhood when, in fact, he had been, and his license plate had been recorded by a neighbor. So there's all sorts of examples of admitted dishonesty that the city cites in its termination letter for Desmond. The town's Civil Service Commission upholds Desmond's termination, and it ends up before a Massachusetts appeals court, which reverses the termination for someone who is dishonest under oath in court. Why? The defense of what's called disparate treatment. Disparate treatment is where an employer treats two similarly situated employees in a different manner. And one of the hallmarks of the requirement for just cause for discipline is that an employer not act in a way that gives rise to disparate treatment. And the court ends up finding that the city has run afoul of this rule. Why? There's another guy in the West Bridgewater Police Department who did worse things. This is a fellow whose name is Officer Kaminsky, who not only wasn't terminated, he wasn't even disciplined. And the court cites Kaminsky's offenses in great length. Bottom line, Kaminsky is involved in a federal prosecution of some bad guy, and the district court judge, the federal court judge, refers to Kaminsky as, and I'm quoting, "perhaps the worst law enforcement witness who was trying to be candid, assuming he was trying to be candid, that I've ever encountered." A federal court of appeals refers to Kaminsky's testimony as riddled with implausibilities and inconsistencies, and it was disbelieved by the trial court in important respects and contradicted by law enforcement witnesses and others. As a result, the First Circuit Court of Appeals vacated the bad guy's conviction, including vacating a 16-year sentence of incarceration. And the court in Desmond's case, in overturning Desmond's termination, said, "What about Kaminsky?" And the court says, "The town never offered an explanation for retaining Kaminsky and terminating Desmond. Kaminsky's blatant falsehoods, resulting in a wrongful conviction and 16 years of prison time, later vacated, were much worse than Desmond's conduct and involved highly material matters leading to prosecution, conviction, and 16 years of prison time for the accused. No legitimate or rational explanation appears." Indeed, Kaminsky's false testimony was highly material, put somebody in jail, while Desmond's had little or no material to the ultimate decision in the TRO for Mrs. A. The court says there's just simply insufficient findings to uphold the discipline in Desmond's case. And it sends the case back down to the local Civil Service Commission to make a decision that is fully supportive of the principle of uniform and fair treatment. Now, does the Massachusetts case come out the same way in New Jersey? I don't think so. Does the New Jersey case come out the same way in Massachusetts? I don't think so. This tells you the importance of the standard of review of disciplinary decisions. If you have a third party who has the ability to make an independent decision on whether discipline should be imposed, you're going to find more discipline overturned by whatever that reviewing body is, a court, an arbitrator, whoever it is. If you have this deferential standard of review that you do in New Jersey, it's going to be as rare as a sunny day in Oregon in December that you're going to find discipline that is overturned. Well, that's it for our July First Thursday podcast. Hey, we've got a seminar coming up in September in Las Vegas. It's on grievances and arbitration, how arbitrators look at disciplinary and non-disciplinary grievances, sort of a how-to manual on writing grievances. We talk about past practices, what's negotiable, what's not negotiable. Hope to see you in Las Vegas in September. We hope to you'll join us here in August for our next edition of First Thursday. With that, it's Will Aitchison signing off.